listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 167 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, your host for the show, and today you're going to hear from performance coach Tom Jackson. Well, before we get into my interview with Tom, I have to say that last year at the DIY Musician Conference, Tom Jackson did his live band makeover, and it's the second time I believe that I've seen it. And every time, it's mind-blowing. It was one of the number one requested things we bring back this year. So you can actually see Tom do a live band makeover this fall, September 30th through October 2nd in Chicago at the 2016 DIY Musician Conference. I highly recommend you go. An enormous amount of great actionable advice to help you move your career forward. Plus, one of the highlights, you'll get to see Tom Jackson do the live band makeover again. Tickets are on sale now. You can get them at DIYMusicianCon.com. That's DIYMusicianCon.com. They sold out last year. We expect they'll sell out again, so don't wait. Currently, they're $99, but it won't stay at that price for long. So head on over, get your tickets. Lots of great announcements about programming and everything happening over the three-day event coming soon. So you'll want to be there. I'll be there. Chris, who's also on the podcast with me, will be there. We're going to be doing some live podcasting there as well. So head over to DIYMusicianCon.com, and I hope to see you in Chicago. Now, as we get into my interview with Tom Jackson, I have to say that it's always surprising to me how controversial the topic of actually training and learning to become a great live performer can be. I always get very strong opinions from artists, some who love it and think it's amazing and it's transformed their show and the amount of money they're making from the merch table every night, and other people just refuse to even consider it. So I would love to get feedback in your feedback and opinions on the episode. You can call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or leave a comment at the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com. If you've got some opinions, if you've tried things that worked, if you've tried things that didn't work, I'd love to hear from you and share on the show. So in this interview with Tom Jackson, we're going to be talking about the four pillars of a successful performer. And I have to say, just because you wrote a song, happen to be holding a guitar, and standing on a stage does not make you a great performer. Really taking note of these four pillars that he has will transform your show, help you sell a ton more merch, build lots of fans, and take your career to the next level. So I really encourage you to pay attention and put these things into practice. So with that said, let's get to my interview with Tom Jackson. Well, joining me on the line is Tom Jackson. Tom, how you doing?
I'm great. Better than I deserve.
Well, it's good to have you on the podcast again. It was great getting to see your live band makeover in person at the DIY Musician Conference this past fall. And you were one of the most requested, if not the most requested thing to have back for our next conference. So I am happy to say that you are confirmed to do the live band makeover again. And we're actually going to clear out a little bit more time for you, so you're not pushed up against other events and make it its own thing. And I think it's going to be really cool. Looking forward to it. It's always amazing to see how you take a band who seemingly thinks that they have a good performance and just take it 10 times higher. So that's always a highlight.
It's always fun.
So today we're going to be talking about the four pillars of a great performer. And I think right out of the gate, that term performer, I think, is a lot of people will say, I'm a musician, so I'm a performer. But I really think that there is a difference between standing on stage and just being a musician and standing on stage and being a performer. And so hopefully we'll get to the bottom of that today.
Yeah.
So lead us to the four pillars of a great performer.
I think what you just said is huge. And I do hope we get to that because somehow because you're a musician that qualifies you as a performer. That's like saying that because you're a musician that qualifies you as a great songwriter. It just doesn't work that way. But so here's the, when I work with an artist, these are the four pillars. And tiles are a funny thing, but it is like building a house to me. And in building a house, the four things I need, I'm going to give you the four things, and then I'm going to dig into them a little
okay.
bit. The first is, when you build a house, the first thing you need is a plan. You need an architect. You know, I ask this question all the time, and the first thing everyone says is foundation. And that is exactly, we want that second. But the first thing is, you got to have a plan. You just can't walk out, the builders drive up and try to figure it out as we go. And that is one of the issues with performers, is they write songs, they walk out and they wing it, and they think it's spontaneity, but it's not. It's winging it, and there's a difference. But the first thing is you need a plan, and we'll dig into that. The second is the foundation. The foundation are the things that we go through mentally, emotionally, psychologically, even spiritually, before we go on stage, while we're on stage. What's going on with us? What's going on with our audience? There's psychology involved in this connection with an audience, both with them, understanding where they're at, and understanding how we can lead them. So the second is a foundation. So we've got the plan. We've to build the house. We've laid the foundation. The next thing we need is what I call materials, tools, and skill. You got to have the materials to put the house up. You got to have the tools to do it. You just can't use a hammer on everything. And you got to have the skill to do it if you want a good house. And that has to do with some of the visual, technical things that happen on stage in a show. A lot of people mistake me for being a quote-unquote choreographer. I don't do choreography. In the big shows that I work on, we bring choreographers in because my whole thing is the overall look at the deal. But there are technical things that artists need to do on stage to keep their show fresh and keep their audience captured and engaged. And the last thing is, after the house is built, you got to move in. So moving in means making this your personality, your show. There's too many generic concerts out there. People don't know what to do, don't know how to bring their personality to the show or to what they're doing on stage. And it really hurts them because one of the things that really sets us apart is who we are. Vocally, you know, I would call it style to some degree, and it's not concocted style. It is who you are. And so those are the four things. It's the architecture, the foundation, the materials, the tools, and the skill, and moving in. Let's start with the architect.
All right.
So my whole thing, my MO is this. You create moments in a show. You don't sing songs. And let's break that down a little bit. See, a song, a well-written song, every once in a while creates a moment live. And we have to understand the difference between writing for radio and live. So when you just play, you could have 12 great songs, and I've done this, 12 great songs on a record given to me, and what I've got to do is find the moments inside those songs, instead of just having the artist play the song and hoping that it works. And that's what most people do. They like back to what I said earlier. A lot of people don't like to have a plan, but planning is a good thing. A great show is a combination of a plan and spontaneity. It's not either or. It's, you know, we've seen canned shows and we've seen, you know, just crappy shows that look and it's because they're overplanned. But the other side of the coin is, how many bad shows are there from people just winging it on stage? So it's a combination of both. It's almost like going on a vacation. You know, you want to have a plan. You know where you're going. You're looking it up. You look at the things you might do on vacation. And you see those moments, those things you're going to do in your mind's eye. But then again, when you get there, you might adjust some or, you know, be spontaneous in certain places, but you still have a plan when you go in. So when I look, there's really 3 hours of this material, but I'm going to give you one part of it, and that is the constructing of a set. Most people, when they do a set, do it 10 minutes to 30 minutes before a show. And, you know, they walk in, get out their pen and paper, particularly if you're in a band, write out a set list, and then they just go. And they don't know, you know, here's a fast one, here's a slow one, let's do this, let's do that. Well, for me, when I put a show together, the idea is, where in the show is the audience going to respond to this song best? What is the psychology behind the audience? And how, for example, first song, how do people want to be greeted? I'm assuming here, let me back up a little bit. I'm assuming here that the people I'm speaking to are dating their audience. They're not married. There's a difference. Married is Taylor Swift going out in front of 20,000 people. She starts singing and 20,000 people jump to their feet and start singing along. You come out, start playing, and people crick their head a little bit, look at you, and try to decide whether they like you. And it's a different relationship with your audience. So how do people like to be greeted? How do people like to discover you? Is it, you know, crazy energy jumping around like crazy? Probably not. Is it really melancholy and deep? Probably not. So what I do is I have a scale that I rate songs on, a scale of 1 to 5. And 5 being the craziest thing going on, just energy all over the place, lots of emotion, not just fast. It doesn't even have to be fast. It can be just huge energy. A 1 is the kind of song that you could hear a pin drop on. Very stripped down, almost nothing going on. Words become the most important thing in a song like that. On a 5, words are not the most important thing. It's the energy. In fact, live, let's face it, particularly if you're playing clubs or different, a lot of the venues, you can't understand the words. So you've got to connect a different way. A 3 is kind of a radio song. It's kind of in the middle. If you listen to radio regularly, songs aren't too energetic. Songs aren't too quiet. So generally, I've got a 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. I take a list, and I write the songs down, and I rate my songs. I sit down and go, okay, what is this? Now for those of you listening who are pretty atypical, you can have a 2.5. You know, and some songs can go from a 2 to a 4. So this is not an exact science. This is just to give you a feel for what your songs are. Because here's what the problem is. It's called the Chinese water torture. Most singer-songwriters, if you watch a singer-songwriter, they'll go from like a 1.5 up to a 3, 3.5, and that's all they'll play the whole night long. And what the pressure never changes on the audience. So what happens, particularly when you're dating, is after 3 songs, they all start sounding the same because the pressure never changes. Let's say I got a 16, 17-year-old, 18-year-old band that just is, you know, punk rock band. Well, they'll start at a 3.5 and go up to a 5, and nothing ever changes. And they're Chinese water torturing their audience to death, and they start sounding the same. And here's the amazing part. Our artists are incredulous. This song's about this. This song's about this. No, this is this. You know, I'm playing a Les Paul in this. I'm playing something in this. But to an audience, they start sounding the same. So again, so the idea here is to evaluate your songs and see, do you have just a bunch of 3s? After a while, your audience, and you're losing your audience by the 4th song. Well, there's a reason for it. So what I do is I rate my songs on a scale of 1 to 5. And again, not an exact science. Then what I do is dive into these songs and I look for the moments inside these songs. Well, let's go back to the first song. I'll give you the psychology of the first song. I'll start at a 3.5. Why? Because people like to be greeted pretty up, not too high, not too low. the song should be easy for the artist to move to. Not that they have to move, but they have to feel really comfortable. You don't want to see somebody thinking on stage, because the truth is, we as people decide probably within the first 20, 30 seconds, maybe a little longer, whether we like the artist or not. And how do we decide? Is it by the lyrical content? No. Is it by the musical prowess? No. It's by who they are. So what you want to do is present your first, what I would call your intro moment, as something that's up, not too high, not too low, 3, 3.5. The song content is to people. So if they can hear the lyrics, it's not a song about your angst. It's not a song about, you know, God. It's not a song about death. It's something that is conversational almost, or storytelling to an audience. So the direction of the words is to people. So for people who are lyric and can hear the lyrics, they realize they're speaking to them. It's not about some obscure thing or something else. It's easy to move to. You're real comfortable with this song. You don't have to be thinking about moving. It's not a song where you go off vocally or musically. You're not trying to show off or show them all your licks in the first song. It actually can come across as arrogant. Now, if you're doing something like a contest or a one song thing, different story.
Yeah.
But what we're doing here is constructing a set of 45 minutes to an hour, maybe. And this even holds true for 20 minutes. You've got to introduce yourself. So how do you introduce yourself? 3, 3.5. The song is to people. It's easy to move to. Not that you have to move, but it's easy to move to if you want to. The song has a trash can ending. Now, what that is, and for some of you artists listening to this, you're like, well, that's not very musical. Trash can ending, everybody on the planet knows this. And it's bam. Why do we put that on the end of the song? Because the audience knows what to do. We are sending a nonverbal signal to them to respond. We're starting to lead them. What happens so often when I watch all kinds of artists, tons of indie artists, they put two or three songs back to back and they never allow their audience to respond. They'll just run right through one and after another, or put a clever ending on the song, some sort of artistic, artsy-fartsy thing. You know, that honestly works great. And here's the problem with that. We hear stuff on records that are like that, and we're like, that is awesome. I'm going to do that in one of my songs. And that's okay for artists who are married to their audience, because they've listened to that song, you know, 50 times, 100 times, 200 times. They know the song is over and it's got, when that clever ending ends. When your song ends, if it's clever, they don't know it's over because they have no reference. So what we want to do is tell them with our ending, song is over, it's your turn to clap. I can't tell you how huge this is. Also, because in the room, there's peer pressure. I don't care what building you go to. People kind of looking around going, is it okay to like this person? So if we put that trash can ending on it and people start clapping, those people that are wondering if it's okay, they'll go, oh, they like him? Okay, I like him too. And so now we're starting to create freedom in the room, which is exactly what we want. Freedom so we can lead them somewhere.
Yeah, the jumping in real quick, I would say that this is probably out of these four pillars the one that I think indie artists struggle with the most, and have honestly usually terrible role models, because they'll look at the major label artists that they like. For example, I went through this in an indie band I was a part of. They would say, well, Radiohead doesn't do anything like this. And I'd be like, well, you're maybe right and you may be wrong. One, I guarantee you there's more planned out than you would ever imagine. It'd probably ruin your ideals of them. But on the other hand, they have the benefit of a massive hit catalog and massive production that masks the idea that they're not doing anything interesting on stage, and that their audience is married to them. It doesn't matter The audience is already sold. They're going to go crazy for them, even if they stand up there and play out of tune and barely get through their songs all night. And so that's the difference. We're not trying to, we don't have that luxury. We're trying to win the audience over so we can get to that point where they just eat anything out of our hands.
That's exactly it. So you've got to understand the psych. That's, you've nailed it 100%. But because we're artists and we got pride and we, seriously,
yeah.
But the truth is we don't carry millions of dollars worth of production. We don't, you know, we don't have all the bells and whistles. We've got to do it with who we are. In fact, on one of, I'm going to drop names here. One of my favorite gigs was in when I was working with Taylor Swift on one of her tours, and there she was going to Europe, and there was not the luxury of a ton of production because you got to go from country to country to country, and it becomes a pain in the you know what.
Yep.
And so the whole idea was to plan the show without the bells and whistles. Let's put it together so that it'll win on a Saturday afternoon in the park. Now, again, she is married to her audience, but the other side of the coin is the idea of making it work without all the bells and whistles. Then if you get to the place where you can add the bells and whistles, oh my gosh, it becomes an amazing show. So yeah, that's exactly it. We watch, you know, Bono do something and go, well, we'll do that. You know, ladies and gentlemen, you know, at the beginning of a show, and people are like, who's this? This is pretentious, you know?
Yeah.
But when U2 does it, people start screaming.
Yep. I wish U2 would go back on tour and get rid of all the production, because I think it's to the point where it's a distraction when you've got a 150-foot screen in front of my face. I just want to see the band play well.
No, I'm with you. If you see them, this is going to sound arrogant. I could kick their butt. They need a kick in the butt.
I would agree.
Yeah, I mean, I love them.
I didn't go to the last tour, but I saw they have it released on HBO. You can watch the whole thing. And frankly, I was disappointed because I felt like the production and what they was a crutch, and they weren't bringing their usual, what the passion was. Yep. Being hidden by all the bells and whistles. And it's like, you know, they'll do fine. Those guys are going to land on their feet. But for for artists watching that, I think they look at it and go, oh, we need production. We need this. And it's like, no, you can kill a room with a microphone and an acoustic guitar if you know what you're doing.
That's exactly right. In fact, Bunny Trailer, I'm sorry, but the production exactly covers up a lot of sins, or takes it, but in some ways it takes away from certain shows that have. Now, on a band like, and I'm going to date myself drastically, Pink Floyd, it's all about the production and the music, and probably, I hate to say it, the drugs people take when they go to see them. And it all meshes together into one great show, at least they think. But the point being, singer-songwriters, I've seen this happen so many times where there's a good singer-songwriter and he's good with songs and his guitar, because his personality comes out, and we'll get into that. But then, and his passion comes out, but then when he puts a band around him, he gets lost because they don't know some of the things to do on the stage to bring that emotion. And I'm not talking about bells and whistles. I'm talking about how do we raise the level of our show, keep that passion, and let it get across when you're also working with the band, because they're two separate things.
Yep.
Singer-songwriter and a band.
Yep.
But anyway, so that's my first song, and those are the kind of things I look at. I'm looking for the psychology of, okay, what does the audience want? It's like this. Look at your set list like going into a restaurant. You have expectations. Your audience has expectations, whether they're conscious or not. You know what? I'm going to move to my second thing here, and I can jump back. The second thing is the foundation. And one of the things in the foundation is understanding your audience. It's huge. It's like going out on a date. It's like going into, like I said, a restaurant. So you go into a restaurant. What is the first thing you expect when you walk into a decent restaurant? You expect someone to sit there, greet you. Or if no one's there to greet you, you expect to see a sign that says, please seat yourself. or wait to be seated. Now we're, and unconsciously we have these expectations. Then we sit down and you expect someone to come and say, would you like something to drink? And we have expectations on serving portion sizes. And we have expectations on all of that stuff. And when those things don't fall into line, we're disappointed. It's not remarkable. It's, and you as an artist need to be remarkable, as Seth Godin would say. Are they going to remark about you? So what we need to do is bring the things in the order they expect them. So your audience has expectations. That doesn't mean change who you are. But if changing a song and putting it first and putting another one seventh and moving these around are the keys, one of the keys to your audience getting what you're about, because you're understanding what the audience wants and when they want it, it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
So the first song, you need a song that you can greet your audience with. At the very end of that trash can ending, what we do is, what we want to do is, and this is, accept applause. We listen to the applause cycle. If they're clapping, we need to give them a cue, both musically, which we did with the trash can ending, and visually, just by at least standing there and acknowledging their applause. If you want to get bold, if you're a hard rock band or somebody's got big energy, you stand out there. That's one of the things I wish I never would have taught Taylor, because she'll stand there for 2 minutes and accept applause. I'm not kidding. But you watch, and the great ones know how to accept applause. You're allowing your audience to express themselves completely because it's a relationship. But when you play 3 or 4 songs in a row and don't allow your audience to express themselves, it's like going out on a date. The girl sits next to you if you're a guy, and for 20 minutes, the guy just talks. So, how you doing? And never allows the person to open their mouth and say, you know, respond.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we need to put a trash can ending, accept applause at the end of our song. And then when the applause has hit its peak and starts coming down, that's where we make our next move, whether it's verbal, whether it's musical, whether it's visual. There's an applause cycle, and we want people to express themselves completely. We don't want it to hit dead air. Everyone in this listening to this has experienced dead air where it's like awkward. But so that's the first song. That's the psychology and the plan for the first song. So when I go work with an artist, I'm planning that. Now, again, if I'm working with, you know, Shawn Mendes or Taylor or whoever, it's a little different animal because they're married to their audience. So on a scale of 1 to 5, I start with the 3, 3.5. Now, we don't have time to go into the entire set list. But what this will do is give you a clue to, if you list your songs, you'll start seeing whether you are Chinese water torturing your audience to death or not. Because what we want to do is change the pressure on an audience. It's almost like, gosh, I hope you guys follow me on this, but it's almost like in sports, in baseball, for example, which just started baseball season, the lineup, you do not have a bunch of home run hitters all the time because you would lose. What you need is speed. You need certain things at certain places to insert into your lineup. You know, your first leadoff hitters, usually the classic guy is fast, gets on base a lot, can steal bases. The second guy moves him along and will sacrifice himself and his batting average somewhat to get him into scoring position. The third place hitter is always your best hitter, average-wise, just your best hitter. Your fourth guy, we all know this, cleanup hitter. He's usually your power guy. My point is, you don't want all just number ones. You don't want all number fours. You've got to have a combination to put a great baseball team together. You've got to have a combination as an artist to do that with your songs too. So what a lot of people have done with this is they've listed their songs and realized where they're lacking. They have nothing that's a 5. They have nothing that's a 1. So what you need to do is either write or go out and find a song that works in that slot. Because we don't want to play a bunch of three and a half. By the time you get to 45 minutes, you might have started with 200 people consciously following you, and you're down to just your family by the end of the night.
I've played that gig.
Yeah, that's why we work together.
Yeah. No, I think it's interesting because the band that you and I did work together on our show was Small Town Poets. And after the time when we were working with you, because you helped us work on a set that was 25 minutes long, and it's still, I've watched videos, still one of the most impactful sets we've ever done. But as we got off that tour and had to start playing an hour and a half again, we were missing that like five moment. Yeah. We wrote a lot of songs that were three and a half, and maybe some two, maybe some four. But we went and put together this kick butt medley of seven songs from the 70s that was just the rock and roll moment of the show, and it killed. And it wasn't just, hey, here's a bunch of cover songs. It was like, we needed this piece in our set, something that's missing, where after that, we're all just friends at that point. Everyone's had their big rock and roll moment. We've played songs they knew and were familiar and somewhat nostalgic, but we're threaded through kind of who we are as a band. And that filled that moment for us that we just weren't ever really going to write ourselves. Cause that, you know, big like rocking moments was just not who we were as a band. We had some rock songs, you know, faster upbeat songs, but not that moment in the set where it just like blows it open.
Yeah. Big fun moment.
Yeah.
And probably the best thing right after that, and I'm going to jump here to probably one of the moments that I try to create in a show is fun moments. It's like going back to the restaurant. You know, I don't care if I'm going to go out and eat at Ruth Chris tonight. I'm not, but but after five bites of that amazing steak, I want something else. I want salad. I want a drink. I want bread. I want rice or potato. I definitely want dessert. And so I look at the fun moment as dessert. Mm-hmm. So, but here's the deal. And you said that you're not like that. Probably 70% of the people listening to this, maybe 80%, are not gregarious and write songs that are huge, fun moments. But I'll tell you this, those huge, fun moments, and you said it, they set up, there's freedom in the room now. They set up the touching moment or the moment that is your best song that you really want them to listen to, and the lyrics are awesome. Because we have changed the pressure on the audience.
Yeah, and it's something that you can actually physically see the difference, not in just how they act, but in their faces, the way they're standing there. They're no longer like arms crossed. They're no longer looking around. It's like they're just beaming and you have them. It's like nothing else matters. We're all just having a good time. We used to call it that. We turned the room into a cauldron of rock and roll joy. So
no, it's good.
That was our and you see how they physically are standing, and you can tell when you've done it just by the way they look. It doesn't matter if they're clapping or not. It's like they could stand there and not clap. It didn't matter. We knew we got the response we wanted.
Yep. Well, that's crucial, Kevin. And we don't have time to jump in this. We'll do this another time. But that goes part of this other architect thing is vision. And having a vision for how the audience is going to respond to certain songs. And you just said it. You knew what response you were wanting out of your audience. And that's the idea here. Each one of these songs should get a little bit different response. And until you get that response and you're working at, that's what rehearsal's for, you need to work towards those responses. When you're sitting playing writing your song, sometimes you can see it in your mind's eye. Oh my gosh, I can see the people crying here. Oh my gosh, I can see them dancing. Oh my God. Well, that's what rehearsal's for. That's what I go into it. I listen to these songs and I see those moments in my head and with talking to the artist. And we try to capture those moments and create those moments in rehearsal. Instead of just learning the song, you go out and wing it and hope something good happens. If you want to do that, you will never, never rise above average. Never. Now, will there be magical nights? Well, of course. You know, one out of 20, one out of 10, but that's inconsistency.
Well, and to me, when you start talking about, you know, you got a plan, then it kind of, you kind of have this foundation of it becoming a part of your show. To me, that's why it's so critical, because so many artists go, okay, you know, maybe tonight will be magical. And it's like, oh, well, the sound sucks. Okay, so it won't be magical because the sound sucks. Or the audience wasn't getting us, so it's not magical. Then, you know, even if you don't do any of these things, occasionally they'll stumble on a show and it feels magical.
That's exactly.
But the idea is to make it magical every night, regardless if the sound sucks, if the crowd is more challenging, if there's less people there than you thought, if there's more people there than you thought, and it's intimidating. It's so you can go out, you have the plan, you have the foundation of understanding that you just go out there and you do it, and it works. And when it works, things like broken gear, sound issues don't become a huge distraction that destroy the show.
Totally. It's going to sound arrogant, but I say this all the time when I'm teaching. You can go out and play a show. Let's say you're doing a Saturday afternoon concert, and then you're playing, and then you know people are coming in. You do your concert, and then 3 hours later, you're doing an evening show. And you could do the exact same show, and the first show is completely magical, and you guys are like high five, and this is awesome. And then the second show, it doesn't work. Here's the problem. You don't know why. You don't know why it didn't work. This is going to sound arrogant. I know why. You can develop a great, consistent professional can win even on a bad night. But if you're just winging it, there's no way. You have no idea what you're doing. And there are actually concepts that you can learn to help raise the level of your show. And this is one of them. Understanding how to put together a set list, whether it's 20 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour and a half, singing one song, doing a showcase. There's a psychology to all of them. And if you ever want to raise yourself above, and let me just be crass, sell more merch. At Blonde, I talked about, we spent 5 days working on stuff, and her merch went up this could sound crazy, 600%.
Wow.
600%. And it was because, and they were the same songs, but we created moments out of them. And we understood this psychology of when to bring those moments. So anyways, that's the architectural form. And honestly, Kevin, I'm not trying to hold anything back. I just got to get through the four, I guess. This is the first one.
Well, you touched on foundation again. Is there anything else we need to talk about in foundation before we talk about materials, tools, and skill?
Sure. I just want the people to know you need to understand your audience. Understanding your audience, and your audience is ignorant. And I don't mean to be, I'm not crass about that. I'm just saying they do not understand musical things. They're not sitting there picking apart. No one in the audience is going, whoa, I like that. You know, third and fifth harmony on the chorus. No one's doing that. If the hairs on their arms raise, they like you. So they don't know how you get there. I always use the example of the movie Titanic, in the scene where he's on that, you know, in the water and she's on that wood, and you know, the dialogue is Jack Rose, while I'm watching the movie. I wanted to stand up and yell, pull him up, because there was room on that door, that stick of wood for both of them. And a lot of people listening to this probably were thinking there was room on that. They should have pulled him up. But the key is this. No one was sitting there going, oh, look at the shimmering lights. Oh, the timing of the dialogue. Oh, none of the technical things. We were caught in the moment. The moment that James Cameron created. And understand this. The two actors, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. James Cameron didn't go out 10 minutes before the scene and say, listen, you guys just go out there. sit on the stick of wood and make something up because you're awesome actors. No, there was a plan. There was intention behind what they're trying to capture. And a great director or producer will have both the form and the spontaneity. So understand your audience does not understand the musical things, but understand that your audience is a genius when it comes to human behavior on stage. When you're standing up there afraid to look at them, afraid to lead them, or just not in control, they sense it. Why? The one thing they're geniuses at is human behavior. They understand when someone's nervous. Why? Because they get nervous. They don't understand Mixolydian scale. They don't understand triple stroke roll. They don't understand high C, or you don't know if they're singing it or drinking it. All they know is if you're nervous, ooh, they can sense that because they get nervous. So understand your audience and what their expectations are. So these three things, folks, write these down. Audiences go for three reasons. They go to be captured and engaged, to experience moments, and to have their lives changed. Now, when I say that, no one sits down and goes, capture and engage me, create some moments, and darn it, change my life. But what they do when those things happen, and what I mean by change your life, for example, is not, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're flying. But you make them think a certain way, change the way they think a little bit. It's like we do this when we watch a movie. I use the example of Schindler's List. After watching Schindler's List, it changed my mind a little bit about things. And Schindler's List has become one of my favorite movies. So if you can capture and engage an audience, now listen, the audience, not you, artist. You're standing on stage, your adrenaline's pumping, people are looking at you, some pretty girl in the fourth row is winking at you. Of course you're captured and engaged, but I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about them. They have sat out there, if you count school, theaters, concerts, church, on and on and on and on, thousands of times watching something. It's not an experience. Their adrenaline is not pumping. They're not. This isn't like really special to them. For you, the artist, it is. So you are captured and engaged. It's about them being captured and engaged. They want to experience moments. This is where I talked about the merch. Everybody I've worked with, their merch sales have gone up because we created moments. And people want to take those moments home. Now, they'll come back to the table and say, where's that song? But here's what they're saying. Where's that song that made me feel that way? Because I want to feel that way again. That's where you'll sell more CDs or more T-shirts. Or get them to sign up for email list because you made them feel something, whether it's joy, hate, energy, fun, whatever it is. You made them feel what, and they want to feel that way again. But if you just sing songs and hope something happens, ain't gonna happen. You'll get some fans, and it'll be a trickle. But you can be intentional about it. So, anyways, that's another little part of the foundation: understanding your audience. That they're ignorant, but they want those three things to happen. And that's the grid I try to run my shows through when I work with an artist. Are we capturing and engaging the audience? Are they experiencing moments? And are we changing their life in some way, shape, or form? So that's the foundation. That's one of about 3 hours of stuff in the foundation. Materials, tools, and skill. Well, I'm just going to ask this question, and it's pretty self-evident. It's rhetorical. Do your songs all sound the same? And of course, if I could hear you all right now, you'd yell back, no, that's crazy. You know, this song, I play this instrument on. This song's about this, different content. Well, if your songs don't sound the same, why do they all look the same? Because they do. You're standing in the same place, doing the same thing over and over, song after song after song after song. And it's a mistake. Now, I'm not talking about acting. I'm not talking about being choreographed. I'm not talking about anything. I'm talking about being creative. Why does a guitar player change from a Les Paul to a Stratocaster, to an acoustic guitar? It's to keep the integrity of the song. That's why we do it. We want to make that song capture the emotion behind it as much as possible. Well, the same thing holds true with the visual stuff. And again, it's not choreography, it's not drama, it's not dance, it's none of that. It's understanding places on stage. If you understood on a song that's a five, that what you need to do is spread the stage. I've got five areas that I talk about going to. I can't point them out because we're in a podcast here. There's tools to use. How do you use a mic stand? Some of you, the mic stand is there. We're changing pressure on the audience again. Some of you, the mic who are real gregarious, the mic stand is there at the very beginning. Somebody introduces you. You go out, get rid of the mic stand, and you hold the mic the entire night. Chinese water torture. What you want to do is have some songs that have that mic stand and that constrains you. Why? Because it changes the pressure on the audience and it captures the integrity of the song more. And some of you are like, okay, I got that. Well, let me just tell you this story. I got a good friend, you probably know him too, Kevin, who played with Prince for 8 years. Prince, they would rehearse before a tour 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, for 6 weeks. When Prince was just starting, he sent the band away for 6 days, and he spent the entire time working on microphone stand technique. Literally. And now we watch Prince and go, oh my gosh, he's just so spontaneous with it. He knows what he's doing. And you see him, he spins around, he plays with it, he plays with his foot, he pulls it out, he puts it back in. It's flawless. 6 days of rehearsing just with a microphone stand, folks.
I thought that was all spontaneous.
Oh, of course, everything's spontaneous. Everyone's just a genius and is comfortable with their bodies. He wasn't comfortable with his body, so he had to work on it. Most of you I'm talking to are not comfortable with your body and expressing yourself physically. Well, this part of the process.
And this was an interesting one that folks that were at the DIY Musician Conference, the live band makeover you did there, I think you saw the perfect example of this. Yeah. Because the band, he did exactly what you said. He walked up to the mic stand. They were, you know, more of a hard rock band. He took the stand, stuck it behind him, and then he just proceeded to basically just sort of have like on stage spasms. that sounds very negative, but it was really just like he was just like didn't know what to do, so he just kind of like ran back and forth and kind of flailed around because in his mind that was high energy, but yep. It was so much constant to take in for the audience. That when you actually worked with him and like had him stop and actually stay in one place and let that energy flow out a little bit more smoothly, it felt much higher energy and he was moving far less.
Yeah. And the problem, and I haven't seen their whole show, but I'm going to predict, and if you're listening to this, you guys, sorry. But
They were good sports.
They were. It was a 45-minute show. He probably did that in every song.
Yeah.
And that's my point. And they're thinking, oh, no, man. When I talk to particularly young bands, they're like, no, we don't need you, man. We run around all the time. I'm thinking, yeah, so what? That's like playing fast leads through every song. Where's taste? You know, it's back to the meal.
Yeah.
You know, if my salad tasted like the main course, and then there's no change. If my bread tasted like the main course, there's no change. My palate and the idea is you got to discover who you are as an artist and what your main course is, but you got to be able to go away from it so that when you come back to it, it means more. So materials, tools, and skill. There's microphone stand technique. I got a little bit of this on YouTube, and obviously you can buy my products and learn this stuff, but I'm not pitching it. Here's another one. How do you get places on stage? Well, I've got it broken down to fundamentals now, four ways to get places on stage. Now, understand, there's more than four ways, but these are the fundamentals. Walk. Easy to say. Some of you walking and singing and walking and playing, you do look spastic. And that's okay if the song is completely chaotic. Then it's the appropriate thing to do. Walk with authority is the second one. So one's like a ballad, you know, low, you're just strolling as you're singing a ballad and telling the story in the song. Two, walk with authority. It's got a little more oomph to it, but it's not real high energy. Third is skip. Now, some people are like, I'm not skipping. Well, you watch bands and you watch Bono. He'll skip, and it because it's appropriate for the song. The song's got energy. So we got to get to someplace on stage fast instead of walk or walk with authority. That's one of the biggest issues is I see groups have this high energy song and the guy's walking over to the side of the stage because he doesn't know how to skip and sing at the same time. And the fourth one is run. And all this is capturing the integrity of the song. We as artists will say, we want to, you know, we're artists, so we want to have some integrity. Well, this is what integrity is. I'll wrap this part up with this. If Kevin's band was doing a show tonight and I was in town with him and he said to me, Tom, I need someone to run lights. And I'm like, dude, I haven't heard your music. He goes, don't worry. The lighting board is real simple. There's three big buttons. You know, they're about 6 inches across. So one of them is green. The green button is just kind of a groove. You just kind of groove, lights come on. You know, they're pretty cool. Red button is they go crazy. Things explode. You know, just crazy lighting going all over the place. The blue button, third button, the blue button is one spotlight in the middle, you know, of the stage and smoke rising up from the stage. Now, everyone listening to this could run those lights.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you start a song that's rocking, we know we're not going to hit the blue button. We're not going to hit the green button. We're going to hit the red button. But what if it's a ballad? We're not going to hit the red button. We're not going to hit the green button. We're going to hit the blue button. But here's the problem with everybody, almost everybody. Green button, green button, green button. And now I'm talking about visually.
Yeah.
No one goes too high. No one goes too low. Back to the Chinese water torture. And we're just feeding that Chinese water torture. So your songs don't sound the same, but they look the same. And here's the problem with that. 55% of communication is what the audience sees with their eyes. If you're dating your audience, 55% is what they see with their eyes. 30% is the tone or emotion you bring something with. 15% is the content of the song. Now, some of you are thinking, that's wrong. I'm sorry, that's live. On the record, it's not 55% what you see with your eyes, CD, whatever, or your recording, whatever we call it these days. There is no visual. So the emotion and the tones and all that stuff and the words become way more important. Just like if there's no music and we had a book, where do you think the words would be? They'd be the most important thing, the only important thing, unless there's pictures in there. So what we want to do is be as creative visually, and you got to have the tools to do this. I just gave you four ways to get on stage. That is something to woodshed, to practice. Some of you are thinking, I got it. No, you don't. No, you don't. Try it.
Yeah, and I think the best thing for artists to do is just to video their shows, because every time you'll think, oh man, we were so rocking. We were all over the place. It was just high energy. And then you watch it and you're like, huh.
Yeah, I felt
a little different than what actually happened.
Back to the audience being captured and engaged, not you.
Yeah.
But let me say this. I'll partly disagree with you that the best thing is to film. Maybe it's the best thing to film is to see how you suck.
That's what I was referring to. Like when you artists that think, oh, we've got this handled. And then you actually see it from the audience perspective, not with the adrenaline of being on stage, and your perception of what happened compared to what you thought happened is different.
Yeah. Because when you watch it, I've been sat in a dozen situations where bands go, let's videotape ourselves. And I'll just sit back and say, you guys tell me what you would improve. And here's what people say. Oh, dude, you need to do something there. Oh, you need to smile there. Always majoring in the minors. Because they don't know how to fix the problem. They don't know how to fix the problem. It's like going to an auto. You know, when my car goes boom, 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 I can open the hood and look at it. But guess what? I don't know how to fix it. I know it's broken. So that's crucial. You've got to take the time to learn how to do a great show, folks. And the last one, move in. make it your own personality. That's huge. When you walk into somebody's house, if they've taken some care, you know, the furniture they've chosen, the music they're listening to, the books they read, they have their own style. Well, your show should have the same thing, because people come to see people, not just hear music. But if they can't discern you from one from another, that's one of the things I don't like about country music right now. Not that I ever did like it, but some of the country music now, I mean, I can't tell one artist from another, and they're all doing the same thing, all wearing the same clothes. And I get it. It's a marketing thing, mass marketing. You got to dig in a little bit deeper to figure out if, you know, it's like Brad Paisley could actually play guitar. But you've got to bring your personality to the show. There's two ways to do this. You develop themes and you develop character. And as simple as this, you look at, and this is creating those moments. When you're looking for the moments in a show, the themes that you want to develop are inside your songs. Let me give you an example and I'll be done. The Simpsons is a 30-minute sitcom. It's been running forever. 22 minutes of content and 8 minutes of commercials is what it really is. 22 minutes of content, 8 minutes of commercials. Now, The Simpsons made a movie about 4 or 5 years ago now. If you'd have walked in that theater, paid your $8, $10, $12, whatever it is, and they would have put on 2 or 3 sitcoms back to back, you would have felt ripped off. Why? Because you could see those things at home. Well, it's the same thing with your record. Your song is like a sitcom. It's short, it's sweet. People listen to it, you know, in familiar places. People go to a concert for a different experience. So how do you give them a different experience? Just like the Simpsons thing, you develop themes and characters. So how do you take look back to the Simpsons, 22-minute sitcom, and turn it into a movie? How long should a good movie be? Rhetorical question. I always hear 90 minutes, 2 hours, 2 hours and 10 minutes. No, none of those are right. a good movie is as long as it works. As long as it works. Schindler's List, which I just talked about earlier, 3 minutes, 8 seconds long. When it was over, I couldn't believe 3 hours had passed by. So when you dig into your songs to create moments, and this is the key, is how you've got to find the things inside your songs that are magical, whether it's background vocals, whether it's a cool rhythm going on to support the song, whether it's a mood on keyboards that you can develop into some cool moment, whether it's a lyrical moment where it's, oh my gosh, these words are so freaking strong, and you set it up with a story. If you've got an unbelievable guitar player, you create moments. Musical moments, touching moments, fun moments. How do you get the audience involved? Like we were talking about earlier. These are things people come to a show for. They don't realize it, but that's what they want. We're back to the meal. If they came out and just put a piece of steak on your plate and said, there's your meal, you'd be like, what? Well, you know, everything else is extra. Don't you feel kind of cheated when people do that to you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what you want to do is develop these moments. You develop themes. Those are the themes. Inside your song, there are cool musical things going on. And here's how I do it. I've got an iPod, and I listen to my iPod changing, because I get the final product from the artist usually. And so I listen to it on different EQs. So when I want to listen to some vocal things going on, I'll pop it on pop. When I want to listen to some rhythmic things going on, I'll roll the tops off. I'll get rid of the highs. When I want to listen to a keyboard part, I'll put it on electronica because that pops out then. My point being, I'm looking for different parts inside the song that you know are there, that the producer knows are there, but the audience doesn't, because audiences are ignorant. So what we want to do, if we got a cool rhythmic thing going on, we develop it. We milk it. We turn it into in some cases I've done, you know, 10-minute drum breakdown where everyone's playing drums. Now, everyone doesn't have to do that, but what you want to do is point out awesome rhythm what you want to point out is awesome background vocals on this one part. We want to point out bridges in some cases. Let's face it, if you're a songwriter, you know that a certain percentage of your songs, even though the chorus is supposed to be the payoff, every once in a while, the bridge is actually the strongest part of the song. But what do we do when we record it? We play it once because we're trying to get that 3.5 minute song. Well, I'll milk that sucker. Let's develop that bridge by doing less, by doing more, by using dynamics. So that's the theme part. The other part is character. And you're the character. You have to present the show in a way that your personality gets poured into the show. And there's by creating a fun moment, that's one way people can see your personality, by you controlling the fun moment, by creating a touching moment and a setup with a story. That's another way people can see your personality, by doing a trade-off. If you're in a band and you got two guitar players, you can play off each other. You can see the personalities of the guitar players as they play back and forth to each other. And I'm not talking about hokey, goofy stuff. The idea is to create space in the show so your personality can come out. In most cases, an artist, the song is in control of an artist, and it's backwards. The song is in control. And that's part of the thing you're talking about with YouTube, Kevin, is the production's more in control rather than the raw emotion that attracted us to them in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It was that emotion and Bono's and the whole thing was just an emotional thing that raised the hairs on you. And now it's slick. And we've lost some of that. And so that's become more in control. Now, if I'm working with them, I would keep some of the production, but I would also leave space for that personality to come out. So even just staying on the one, and I'll finish with this. Here's a perfect example. Your intro, folks. I hear a lot of singers and songwriters that'll be saying in their head, well, that's good about moving, but I'm stuck behind a microphone stand. No, you're not. Let's say you've got an intro of a song. Now, you could step out a couple steps, play that intro on your guitar to the audience, and then get back to sing. Well, here's the problem. Your intro is so short because you've written a 3-minute song that by the time you walk out and play the intro, you've got to get back to the microphone. Am I right? The answer is yes. Well, here's how we solve it. You play the intro 2, 3, 4 times to capture them, bring them into it. Then instead of getting into the vocal immediately, you land on that first chord. You watch some of the great pros, and they'll do this all the time. Springsteen does it. Prince does it. They'll land on the one. Dun, 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 and they'll just vamp there, lay there for a minute. No hurry to get back to the mic. Then they'll walk their way back to the microphone. And this allows himself to go out and connect with the audience, look at people, bring some life to them, change the pressure on the audience, land on the one, give you the authority. They're not going, oh my gosh, he's got to get back. He's got to get back. Yet in the back of your head, you go, I got to get back to the microphone. I got to get back to the microphone. And as soon as you start doing that and the song takes control, you lose authority. You're no longer confident. They'll not respect you as much because they're like, well, this isn't the real deal, because you don't see the real deal people doing that. So I don't know if that last part made sense about landing on the one, but.
I understood. I think that's the tendency, like you're saying, is people, they've got a song, you know, an extended intro sounds funny on a recording if nothing's happening, but live, like you're saying, there's all sorts of other things happening, and a lot of it's visual, and so you perceive things differently. I also think, you know, like when some of the work we did with you with Small Town Poets, that was an eye-opening thing, is that we had a song that would fall more in the ballad range. It's probably like a 2 on your scale rating. And on the record, there's this intro and there's the kick drums just playing 4 on the floor, and it works perfectly fine. But live, that kick drum was so massive in the sound system that it destroyed kind of the moment, and it also just it made you feel like you needed to move on to the next part of the song quick. It was just when we took that out and it opened up that song, it was like, hey, we can play this more. We can build this more. And there's a lot more space here and we can have it be a time where it's more about, you know, like we can start injecting more personality in some of those things as opposed to feeling like, hey, you know, you could get any five guys to just come and play this song down live.
Right. And so, the key is you being in control instead of the song. And your arrangement live needs to be different than your arrangement for record in most cases. I've changed, and some people think that's sacrilegious, but I've changed over 100 number one songs. And at first I was, boy, you know, I did think it was sacrilegious. I even changed two Beatles songs with one of the best, with the Fab Four. Now that was sacrilegious. Now I'm not going But anyways, so those are that's it. The building a house, and we just I can't say we just scratched the surface, but
yeah,
you got pieces of it.
Yeah, oh yeah, there's lots to talk about, and it's so important. I think, you know, when it comes down to shows. And people, like what you were saying, that it's changing the song. I can't do that, but it's a totally different experience. The person listening to an album, especially these days, it's usually very personal. They usually sit either in their car by themselves or have headphones on at work, and it's just them and the music. But when you go to a show, there's so much more happening that, you know, that cool guitar lick, you just play it once and it's gone and it never happens again. They barely had a chance to even grasp it because there's so much other things happening around them, that stimulation, that's, you know, visual, the people next to them talking and being irritating or whatever. You know, there's just so much happening that you don't have a chance to even hook onto it as an audience member, but you could in headphones sitting by yourself at work.
Yeah, and if it's a cool part, why not do it more?
Yeah.
And be in the live setting, because you're right, because there's distractions and there and it's just a different experience. Again, the difference between sitting and watching The Simpsons at home and going to a movie, it's a different experience. And there's rules. Some people make great movies and are terrible at sitcoms. And some people are great at sitcoms and they couldn't make a movie if their life depended on it. And that's what I guess makes the world different.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Where can people find out more about what you do and your teaching materials? I know you have a lot of great resources that I've known many people have used over the years and had really great results when they actually put it into practice. So where can people listening find out more?
OnstageSuccess.com. OnstageSuccess.com. And a quick little jab here. If somebody's actually out playing a lot of shows, I also have artist support. We never got to that. It was not the intention today. But you can also go to Live Music Gives if you're playing quite a few gigs. LiveMusicGives.com. Find out about our artist. We give artists money and hook them up with charities. So I can help you financially by helping you with your show because you'll sell more merch, and I can help you financially by partnering you with a charity that'll make a difference both for you and for a kid out there.
All right. Excellent. And I will put links to that in the show notes of the podcast. And yeah, check that stuff out. And Tom, looking forward to having you back again at the DIY Musician Conference coming up September 30th through October 2nd. And we're going to have another live band makeover, and who knows what else we'll do. But it'll be a good time. It's always amazing to see because, like I said, this past one, the band came out and played, and everyone, I looked around the room like, huh, that wasn't bad. And then they were just blown away by what you took their, huh, that wasn't bad performance and turned it into just in the matter of like 45 minutes. So we gave you more time this year.
Yeah.
And going to have some, I think, another amazing experience that's just a testament to how important it is to pay attention to what you're doing on stage.
Good. I'm looking forward to it. Always.
All right.
All right, Kevin.
Thank you.
Talk to you.
Well, Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks again to Tom Jackson for coming on the show. You can check out all his information and get his books and videos at onstagesuccess.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And again, the DIY Musician Conference in Chicago, September 30th through October 2nd. Tom will be there. I'll be there. You'll see a live band makeover happen before your eyes. We can talk. We can hang out. We can exchange ideas. You should be there. Go to DIYMusicianCon.com to get tickets and learn more about the event. And if you want to weigh in on this episode of the podcast, you can call 360-524-2209. Email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or, you know, check out the website. Leave some comments with the show notes, and myself and other folks will weigh in as well. Well, I think that's it. Hope to see you in Chicago, and we'll catch you next time on the podcast. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.